What comes to your mind when you hear someone insist on the truth? Does it fill you with confidence, or does it make you a little bit nervous? In the opening three verses, this author insisted on truth no less than four times. So we will be talking about truth this morning. But we begin by recognizing that for some people, truth is not easily accepted, especially in a modern context like ours, one that's been described by many as a post-truth world, where people no longer believe that absolute truth even exists. There is only your truth or my truth, but there's no fixed truth. Within this cultural landscape, the concept of truth has also been weaponized, hasn't it? In certain circles, when someone hears a truth claim they may not like to hear, the response is often hostile. You're a bigot. You're arrogant. You're intolerant. You're divisive. In this way, we recognize that there are some people who reject truth as an enemy rather than an ally. And add to this that even amongst Christians, truth can be a hot potato, partly because some have clumsily handled the truth like a hand grenade, inflicting more damage than good. For others, we're unsure if Christian truth even exists because so many Christians disagree on so many things. Kevin DeYoung identified this problem and wrote in an article, "Everyone agrees that church unity is important. Everyone agrees that being true to Scripture is important. Everyone likes the saying, in essentials, unity, in non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, charity. But no one can agree which are which." So we have to acknowledge, at some level, the insistence on truth or possessing the truth can be difficult terrain to navigate, and that for Christians and non-Christians alike. But that is not the same as saying that we ought not to navigate the terrain of truth together, or that truth cannot be discovered, believed, or celebrated. Indeed, truth need not be our enemy. We need not see the truth as our enemy, but it is our ally. We know this. We know this from real life experience. Think about an abuse victim. Think about an abuse victim who confide in a trusted friend. In that situation, they hope that truth will be their ally, that speaking the truth will protect them from further harm. Truth, in other words, can be an ally. It does not need to be our enemy. And this is how the writer of 2 John uses the word truth. He sees it as his ally, not his enemy. It is a positive word, not an abusive one. So let's see what we can learn from him about the goodness of truth in Christian community. As we dive in, it's helpful for you to know that I interpret verse 1 in a particular way. It sets the scene for what lays ahead in the letter, so I do interpret it in a particular way. Let me explain. Verse 1 reads to us, "The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth." Though the text doesn't say it explicitly, I take the elder to be Jesus' beloved disciple John, who penned the fourth gospel account, the three smaller epistles, bearing his name, and also the book of Revelation. This is just classic Christian understanding of authorship about these letters. But secondly, I take the elect lady and her children not as a reference to an individual and her biological children, but to a church and those who are associated with that church. The church and her members. The lady is a church, and her children are those people associated with that church. In other words, John is using a literary device. It's a personification. He's personifying the Christian church. And that's further supported for those of you who are keeping record in verse 13, where he says that your elect sister and her children send her greetings. That is a reference to a sister church who is sending their greetings along with John's letter. I point this out because it'll help us appreciate the congregational nature and application of this letter, rather than thinking of 2 John simply in terms of personal and private application. It is written to a church, so it is for the church to apply amongst themselves. With that said, what are we looking at in this letter? What's going on here? Why did John bother to write the second epistle? Commentator David Jackman summed it up nicely. I could do no better. The most pressing question, which clearly exercised John's mind and burdened his spirit, was how these young churches were to be kept strong in the true faith and how they were to maintain their priorities with both unswerving orthodoxy and vigorous spiritual life. That is what lay ahead for us over the next 4 weeks. A letter encouraging us to maintain unswerving orthodoxy, a commitment to the truth, and a vigorous spiritual life expressed in love. These go hand in hand, as I hope that we'll discover in our time ahead. So when we're talking about unswerving orthodoxy, we are, of course, talking about truth. And that includes questions like, what is true? What can we know? What do the scriptures teach? And as we've already noted, whenever someone talks about truth, some may become quite nervous or anxious or defensive. And maybe you even felt that way when we read this letter, this epistle, and all its numerous ways in which it spoke about the truth. And in many ways, if that's you, if you're nervous about people who speak about possessing the truth, as though they have something true and fixed and concrete to claim, if that makes you nervous, I sympathize. I sympathize with that. I know what it's like to be among people who champion the truth, but do so in harsh and insensitive ways. I've been there. I know what that's like. As a friend of mine wisely observed, some people use the truth to blind people rather than illuminating a path along which to walk. Strange how we as Christians can do that. We use the truth to blind people rather than illuminating a path along which to walk. So I assure you, it's no fun being on the receiving end of such blinding light. But the alternative to this is not to throw away our interest in the truth, but to come to Christ and to learn how to attain, handle, share, and grow in the truth. But to come to Christ to attain the truth does mean that the truth must actually be attainable. we must actually be able to get our hands on a thing called truth. In other words, Christianity is not like endless seasons of the X-Files that tell us that the truth is out there, just beyond our reach. Rather, Christians believe we can get our hands on the truth. It is within reaching distance. We can know the truth, truly. And more specifically, Christians subscribe to a correspondence view of the truth. In the words of philosopher and apologist Douglas Hurtes, the correspondence view of truth, held by the vast majority of philosophers and theologians throughout history, holds that declarative statement is true if and only if it corresponds to or agrees with factual reality, with the way things are. In other words, you can know the truth because the truth lines up with the real world. It lines up with the way that things really are, not with the ways that we might prefer them to be. The truth lines up with the way things really are, not just with the ways that we might prefer them to be. If I said to you, this is an example, if I said to you that I have a brown desk in my office, that is only true if I do in fact have a brown desk in my office. Not just if I wish there was a brown desk in my office. It must line up with reality. When the scriptures say that God raised Jesus from the dead after he made atonement for sin, that is the truth if and only if God actually did raise Jesus from the dead. The truth claim must line up with reality. That is how we know what truth is. For now, it is enough for us to see that John actually believed, unlike modern skeptics, that truth actually exists. And not only that it exists, but that it can be known. Verses 1 and 2. The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth, because the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. So in just those two verses, I'd like us to notice three things. Here's your Presbyterian part of the sermon. 3 points. Three things I'd like you to notice. Firstly, truth is coupled with love. Truth is coupled with love. John loved this church that he's writing to in truth. And not only him, but other Christians who had a handle on the truth love this church also. If you're doubtful, if you are uncertain about whether there is such a thing of truth as truth, does this surprise you? Well, for those of you who have experienced truth warriors as harsh and insensitive people, does this grab your attention at all? John insisted on truth, but in such a way that produced love. He insists on the truth, but in such a way that it produced love. You know, so often we fail in this area of truth because we divorce it from love. We say you may be truthful but not loving. Or you may be loving but not truthful. We struggle to put the two together. And as a consequence, we end up playing them off against each other like they are enemies rather than allies. We all need help in this department, and we always will, I'm sure. But the help we need is not found in discarding love in favor of the truth, or to discard truth in favor of love. The two go hand in hand. They are allies. As John Stott said so well, we can't increase our love for one another by minimizing the truth we hold in common. There's no way that you and I can love each other any better if we minimize the truth that we hold in common. As you consider John's words, how he and other Christians loved this church, they loved it precisely because of their common interest in the truth. Which means that this wasn't a wishy-washy sentimentality. It wasn't just a sentimental love. It was a stable and a strong love nurtured in the soils of truth. The second thing to notice is that John tells us truth is knowable. We've been over this a little bit already. In the modern world, many say it is arrogant to claim knowledge of the truth. Others have taken a view of relativism. The relativist simply says that there is no truth, or that all truth is relative. You have your truth and I have my truth, but there is no objective or absolute truth for us to discover and agree upon. The best we can hope for is to speak our own truth. It's very hard to convince a police officer of this relativism when you've been caught doing 115 kilometers an hour, isn't it? I mean, it's very hard to do relativism in the real world. His radar clearly says you were doing 115 kilometers an hour. And you're trying to convince him that that is simply his truth. Your truth is that you were actually doing 80. Relativism doesn't correspond to reality. But look at what John said. Those sending their love greeting to this church are Christians who know the truth. They've actually found it. They're holding on to it. It is not relative. It can be known. Truth is knowable. And then thirdly, we are told that the truth is not simply an abstract thing out there for us to examine or to scrutinize or to investigate or in order to produce another encyclopedia for us to fill our heads with. He said in verse 2 that truth abides in us and will be with us forever. It abides and it is with us. In other words, truth is homely. It's a homely thing. When you get your hands on it, it delights the soul. Some years ago, I watched an astrophysicist, Dr. Jason Lyle, demonstrate fractals using computer-assisted animations. And you're probably thinking that's a really geeky thing to do. And it probably is. But there's a point to this illustration. See, on its own, fractals are just mathematical equations, something like this. As they exist on paper, it just doesn't look like there's a lot of life in that, does there? Who would be happy about seeing some equation like that? But watching Dr. Lyle explain and animate and enjoy the beauty of fractals and all their detailed complexity was fascinatingly enjoyable. Why? Because the mathematical truth was homely to him. It abided in him. He enjoyed knowing what he knew, and that animated his joyful demeanor. He loved the truth, and it animated his joyful demeanor. And so with Christians, we are not satisfied with basic facts about God. We are not satisfied with just reciting our confession of faith. We are not satisfied with parsing our Hebrew and our Greek. We are not satisfied with our textbooks of razor-sharp Reformed theology. These are all true and good things. Don't misunderstand me. We celebrate, we long for these things, we pursue them actively. These are good things. But these good things must bring us to the point of animating our love for God and for one another. They are not ends in themselves. They must animate us to love God and others. This is what we see in verses 1 and 2. John was animated by the truth to love the church, as were other Christians. So let me say it once more. Truth is not the enemy of love. They are allies. They belong together. They produce a vibrant spiritual life. And this vibrant spiritual life is what John emphasized in verse 3. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son, in truth and love. These are the high points of Christian joy and contentment. And it is given to us here in a highly concentrated and potent form. Namely, when we talk about grace, we are talking about God's unmerited favor to us sinners. When we are talking about God's mercy, we are talking about God's unmerited favor actually being expressed to us. And it is in this knowledge that God is gracious and merciful by which we experience peace with Him. But carefully note, this knowledge, and it is knowledge, of God's grace, mercy, and peace, the good things that we actually want to be sure of in the Christian life, we do want to be sure of God's grace and mercy and peace. This knowledge wasn't based on a wishful thought or a dream or a fleeting hope that John had one evening. John didn't say, "I sincerely hope you'll have grace, mercy, and peace." His words are exacting. They are precise. He said, "Grace, mercy, and peace will be." Note those words, "will be with us." It is a sure thing. He could take this to the bank. How could he be so sure? How dare he be so arrogant? How dare he be so certain about anything? I submit to you that John could only arrive at such certainty, such surety of confidence about God because he had come into a knowledge of the truth. He had come to a point of conviction and certainty about God and the person and work of Jesus, whom he knew personally. So too, we must come to a point of settled belief, of certainty about God and the person of Jesus Christ. This is where the kind of love that John wrote about will grow in the fertile soils of biblical truth, comprehended, celebrated, and treasured within Christian community. That is where love grows. This said, we Christians readily admit and confess that all our earnest attempts at truth and love often remain prone to messiness. Often in our zeal for both truth and love, we make a mess of things, don't we? But this does not mean that neither truth or love exists, or that it cannot be attained, but rather it shows that we Christians too are still sinners. Our discipleship is not yet complete. And our problem usually stems from being too zealous in one direction rather than both. At times we're all about the truth, but we are failures when it comes to love. Others overreact towards a sentimental love, but are failures when it comes to truth. So what are we to do? What are we to do? We need Jesus. He knew how to do both perfectly. He loved so well. Consider as you read about him in the gospel accounts that he loved so well that children and prostitutes and tax collectors and lepers enjoyed his welcome. They enjoyed his welcome. What a loving person he must have been to be around. And at the same time, he presented the truth perfectly. He prophesied judgment on the unrepentant. He called sinners out of their sinful ways. And he upheld the law of God with uncompromising courage. Little wonder it is said of him, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And it is the same Jesus who instructed us, his disciples, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. We are meant to come to Jesus, to learn from him, to see how he did it, and then, with all our foibles and imperfections, put truth and love into practice also. Just because we know we're going to stumble along the way does not mean we shouldn't show up for the race. Show up, run with truth and love, and confess when you get it wrong. So we come to Christ to learn from him. But we come to Jesus as far more than our personal life coach or our moral example. We come to him first and foremost because God the Father has drawn us to him, and to see our salvation in this Jesus. That our peace with God could only come by way of his life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. This is God's declaration of love and truth to the world. So come, come to Jesus, trust him, and so have peace with God.